From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, experts say the violence in France is part of a clash of values. Pessimism about controlling terrorism in the near future.
Terrorism is exceedingly difficult to stop because it's so easy to produce. It really doesn't take very much to alarm the public.
A look at the origins of the Ebola virus. And a U.S. delegation is focusing on business opportunities with India. I'm Susan Yawkey. The attack on the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo in Paris on Wednesday was not the first such clash between the European media and militant Islamists. VOA's Al Pessin reports from London. Such incidents highlight a fundamental difference of values.
As thousands in France and many other countries gathered to mourn the people killed on Wednesday, they engaged in a little freedom of expression of their own. Some carried a cartoon reading, "Love is stronger than hate," while others held up homemade signs saying, among other things, "Freedom of the press is priceless." But not everyone agrees with that. This was the second attack on the Paris satirical newspaper. A Dutch newspaper's cartoons about the Prophet Muhammad caused protests in many countries and several violent incidents in 2005. And a Dutch filmmaker was killed in 2004 after producing a documentary about the treatment of Muslim women. Experts say the violence is part of a clash of values between the Western view of press freedom and traditional Islamic views, placing more emphasis on respect for authority and particularly religious figures, and barring the use of the human form in art. Carol Kirsten is a senior lecturer on Islam at London's King's College.
When that is pushed to the limit provocatively in satirical media, it's almost a godsend excuse for radicalists to jump on these kind of matters.
But he's quick to add that the views of the militants do not reflect the thinking of most Muslims.
You could see it also today in the social media that a lot of Muslims admitted they felt offended for any, you know, satire that involved the Prophet, but they would never ever see that as condoning killing those who made these pictures.
Indeed, officials and religious leaders in several Muslim countries, including Libya, condemned the Paris attack. The murdered cartoonists of Charlie Hebdo and their colleagues engaged in a hard-hitting, no-holds-barred form of satire. They tweeted this caricature of the leader of the Islamic State militant group shortly before the attack.
I believe it's part of journalism. I mean, the cartoon is part of the tradition of journalism, going back hundreds of years, really.
Gavin Evans is a journalist and senior lecturer at the London School of Journalism. He spoke via Skype.
People who believe they are beyond having fun poked at them deserve to have fun poked at them. And I think that's part of this kind of cartooning.
Evans points out that Charlie Hebdo made fun of other religions, too, and even lampooned the Pope. Now he's concerned that journalists will be more timid.
Any editor who has a cartoonist who is likely to depict anything relating to fundamentalist Islam is now more likely to be cautious because of this kind of reaction.
Some newspaper editors decided not to reprint the Charlie Hebdo cartoons about Islam, but for now there is no such timidity at London's independent newspaper, which had a front-page cartoon of its own with a message for terrorists so strong it cannot be broadcast. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Max Abrams is a terrorism expert with Northeastern University and also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He is not optimistic about curtailing terrorist acts in the near future.
Well, I think that they are going to continue to happen. I was asked, you know, is the lone wolf threat and our threats of sleeper cells and small groups of terrorists attacking, like in Paris, are those a bigger concern in, say, London or Paris or Washington, D.C.? And in my opinion, everywhere it really is fair game. The reality is that terrorism is exceedingly difficult to stop because it's so easy to produce. It really doesn't take very much to alarm the public. Furthermore, it's not particularly hard to harm the public and to generate massive amounts of media attention. And this is particularly true, of course, within democracies. And so I see no end in sight to these kinds of attacks. In terms of the particular mode of attack, I do believe that that's a response to improved counterterrorism measures. Basically, Al-Qaeda and Islamic State have difficulty dispatching terrorists from these conflict zones to the West. And so for years now, they've been calling on Muslims local to, you know, these Western countries to attack there. And so that applies whether we're talking about a lone wolf attacker or whether we're talking about a couple brothers, as it seemed like what happened today in Paris.
Well, what can be done to deter future attacks?
Well, I think that terrorists are motivated by all sorts of different goals. And that really makes counterterrorism difficult because the point of counterterrorism, of course, is to deprive utility to the perpetrators. And so some terrorists, you know, they want to be famous. And so the media might not, you know, sort of exalt these people as terrorist masterminds in the sophistication of the attack. Others want to martyr themselves. Others do it for the money, or even frankly for the women, or for a sense of adventure, or a sense of purpose in life. And so there are many different drivers to terrorism, and that's what makes it so difficult. And I think that we need to carefully consider what is it exactly that terrorists want, and what's the best way to deprive them of getting it. Only if we're able to do that will we dissuade them from participating in terrorism.
Well, how far can governments go to control terrorism? I mean, they have to tread lightly in some ways to avoid stepping on civilian rights.
That's absolutely true. It's not just a moral issue, the protection of civilians. It's also a strategic issue. And the reason is because probably the worst thing that a government can do for counterterrorism is to overreact. It's actually better to underreact. It's better to do nothing than to react sort of indiscriminately and punish law-abiding citizens, because that sort of behavior only incentivizes them to join forces with the terrorists. And so the French government, in this case, needs to be very careful about not overstepping its bounds in a way that will ostracize the 5 to 6 million Muslims living in France. Because if the government does that, you're going to see more and more volunteers and recruits for these kinds of Islamist groups, because French behavior will sort of be a realization of their worst fears, that, you know, that the government is hostile to Islam and hostile to Muslims. And this is an issue that the United States has been dealing with for a long time as well. You know, even our, you know, seemingly benevolent policies in the Muslim world are not interpreted that way. And the United States is frequently labeled as, you know, as evil, and this only strengthens the position of the terrorists. So I think that France needs to be very careful. I think that the best counterterrorism response is a very strong one directed against the culprits, but that one that doesn't exceed those bounds and harm the rights of law-abiding citizens. And that really is a strategic issue as much as a moral one.
Max Abrams is a terrorism expert with Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts, and also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
The Ebola virus has taken the lives of more than 8,000 people in West Africa since the epidemic began last year. The virus also killed an estimated 5,500 gorillas in the Losi Sanctuary of the Republic of Congo in 2003. However, Ebola did not originate with these latest human and animal tragedies. Dr. Robert Cohen is a preventive medicine physician at the U.S. Army Public Health Command in the U.S. state of Maryland. In his studies of the origin of the Ebola virus, he found that Ebola and its strains have been around for millions of years. He tells VOA's Kim Lewis, through various conditions made by environmental and population changes, Ebola has been able to mutate and makes its way from primates to humans.
The short answer is that Ebola is a type of virus that is the kind that mutates all the time, and chances are good that it has been mutating for a long time. In this particular case, what appears to have happened is, as these viruses do, it mutated into a strain that was able to jump into humans, and because of human encroachment into the forest and decline of other animal populations that might have shielded us from the virus as it was in its natural reservoir, it was allowed to propagate within its natural reservoir, which is very likely bats. And as humans encroached into the forest and interacted with the bats more and more over the course of the last 50 or so years, the probability of spillovers from bats into humans increased. And unfortunately, at this point, the virus is now established itself within its natural reservoir, and continuous interactions and encroachments by humans into the forest has led to several instances of the spillover of this new strain of Ebola into humans.
There are other infectious diseases that you mentioned in an article that was seen in the Baltimore Sun, and you mentioned SARS and MERS and bird flu. Are these types of viruses, do they have the same type of, I guess, different strains?
Yes. The type of virus that we're talking about, there's two types. There's RNA and DNA. RNA is the type that is Ebola, HIV, SARS, MERS, avian flu, etc. And RNA tends to mutate faster than DNA viruses. So there's two types of that. There's single-strand or double-strand. Single-strand viruses tend to mutate faster than double-strand. And almost all of the really bad pathogens that come from animals are single-strand RNA viruses, just like Ebola. And the reason the single-strand RNA viruses mutate so quickly is just because of their biochemistry. That is what allows them to continuously mutate so quickly within animal populations, and so, not on purpose, but find new mutants that allow themselves to jump easily into humans.
What lies ahead for humans regarding future outbreaks of infectious diseases such as Ebola?
2 years ago, no one necessarily would have foreseen or predicted an outbreak of 20,000 cases in West Africa of Ebola, because all the previous outbreaks had been on the order of no more than 1,000 or even in the range of 500. And suddenly we saw this very large outbreak in West Africa. So the public health community is monitoring for all of these diseases. But it's worth remembering that the worst of all of these types of RNA viruses that jump from animals to humans is HIV, which was very good at establishing itself in humans and has, of course, killed 40 million people and infected approximately that number alive today. So the chances are good that in these tropical rainforests of South America, Africa, and Southeast Asia, there is very high biodiversity there, different types of animal species that harbor different types of viruses. And there are rarer viruses that the general public is not aware of that the public health community is quite concerned about. You mentioned a few of them. I would mention that the story of Nipah virus in Southeast Asia is also one that is alarming and scary. Bird flu for the same reason. There is very good reason to believe that if the trends that are bringing this about are not abated quickly, we will see a worse epidemiologic pattern of worse and new RNA viruses or worse outbreaks in the relatively near future.
It seems like it's going to take both a collaboration with governments and scientists doing this. How are they going to be able to come together?
That remains to be seen, to be sure. I agree with you, and I would add the general public also really have a role to play. All three of them are certainly capable of doing their job. We've seen evidence of scientists doing the right thing, various governments in some places doing the right thing, and individuals taking ownership of protecting their own lands or maybe reducing the amount of resources we demand from the rainforest, whether locally or the things that are exported from those countries. We've seen all of those individually. We face many of these what I would call slow-motion emergencies that are really emergencies and have to happen now. And it's not just these, but the sharp growth of the human population or climate change, any number of the other environmental emergencies that are going on. We have yet to really put forward our best effort, and it really depends on all of those efforts doing better than they've done to this point.
Dr. Robert Cohen, a preventive medicine physician at the U.S. Army Public Health Command. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry travels to South Asia on Saturday in a bid to promote economic ties with India. Kerry and U.S. business leaders will attend a global investors summit inaugurated by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has details.
Kerry's trip to India comes after Prime Minister Modi visited Washington in September and discussed trade and business investment with President Barack Obama. Kerry will use his visit to set up Mr. Obama's trip to India later this month, says State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki.
Certainly they'll be discussing the president's upcoming trip, as well as our economic relationship, our strategic relationship, our relationship on issues like energy.
Prime Minister Modi campaigned on a platform of economic revival. As a result, the stakes are high for him at the Investors Summit, says South Asia analyst Michael Kugelman.
He won by a huge margin in the election to repair the country's economy. And it's very risky for him because there's such high expectations from the populace for him to do things and quickly.
Kugelman says the prime minister will need to assure U.S. officials that India is addressing some of the problems that have made trade and investment difficult in the past.
It's an open secret that for as much investment, as much foreign investment there has been in India over the last few decades, it still is exceedingly difficult to start businesses and to do things along those lines.
Despite past difficulties, which include bureaucratic red tape and concerns about patent protection, there are opportunities to improve U.S.-India trade ties, says South Asia Center Deputy Director Bharath Gopalaswamy.
I think the defense is a bigger sector. That's been one of the contentious sector as well, but as a very big sector. Education is a key area in which investments, you know, postgraduate education, collaborating with Indian universities, setting up Indian facilities, lab facilities in India that promotes these, that supports higher education and research opportunities. Those are some of the key areas that are available.
Gopalaswamy says the trade relationship between the U.S. and India is still in its discovery phase with room for significant growth. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
Several hundred fans joined American singer and actor Elvis Presley's family in Memphis, Tennessee Thursday on what would have been the King of Rock and Roll's 80th birthday. An American pop culture icon like few others, Presley rode high in the music charts in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s before his death in August 1977 at the age of 42. His legacy includes 108 songs on Billboard magazine's Hot 100 Pop Music chart, as well as 33 movies. One of Elvis's early movies was Jailhouse Rock, released in 1957. Here he sings the movie's title song. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey, reporting to you from Washington.
This is Today in History. On January 9, 1788, delegates meeting in the city of Hartford voted overwhelmingly to ratify the U.S. Constitution, making Connecticut the fifth state in the United States. In 1861, the U.S. merchant ship Star of the West came under fire as it attempted to resupply the Union garrison at Fort Sumter in Charleston, South Carolina Harbor. The incident, just weeks after South Carolina had seceded from the Union, took place 4 months before Confederate batteries fired on the fort, the opening shots of the American Civil War. In 1909, Ernest Shackleton, the leader of an expedition to the South Pole, planted the British flag 97 nautical miles from the pole, the closest anyone had come to reaching it at that time. In 1913, Richard Nixon, the 37th President of the United States, was born. Nixon became the first president to resign his office after Congress began impeachment proceedings against him due to the Watergate scandal. Nixon's career included time in the U.S. House and Senate, as well as 2 terms as President Dwight Eisenhower's vice president. Besides Watergate, Nixon is remembered for his efforts to open relations with China. In 1945, the U.S. 6th Army, under the command of General Douglas MacArthur, made an amphibious landing on the beaches of Luzon in the Philippines, another step in retaking the islands from the Japanese in the closing months of World War II. In 1951, the United Nations headquarters complex in New York City was officially opened. In 2007, Apple CEO Steve Jobs unveiled the first iPhone. The popularity of the iPhone reshaped the smartphone industry and helped make Apple one of the most successful technology companies. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been called the city of light and love, but darkness and hate were on display in Paris when masked gunmen stormed into the offices of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and shot to death 12 people and wounded at least a dozen more. The magazine is known for its lampooning of religion and religious leaders of all faiths, including Islam. One of the assailants, all 3 of whom escaped the scene, was captured on video shouting, "Allahu Akbar." Condemnation of the terrorist attack poured in from around the world, including from the Arab League, the French Muslim Council, and Al-Azhar, one of the premier Islamic institutions of the Sunni Muslim world, from Russia, India, Britain, Germany, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, the United States, and others. President Barack Obama called the attack cowardly and evil. He offered the French government any assistance it may need going forward and pledged to stay vigilant in hunting and bringing to justice the perpetrators of this attack and rolling up the networks that help to advance these kinds of plots. "The fact that this was an attack on journalists," said Mr. Obama, "underscores the degree to which these terrorists fear freedom of speech and freedom of the press." But, he insisted, "the values that we share with the French people, a belief, a universal belief in freedom of expression, is something that can't be silenced because of the senseless violence of the few." U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry also spoke about the attack in Paris as an attack on the fundamental right to free expression.
"Free expression and a free press are core values. They are universal values, principles that can be attacked but never eradicated, because brave and decent people around the world will never give in to the intimidation and the terror that those seeking to destroy those values employ. I agree with the French imam who today called the slain journalists martyrs for liberty."
Mr. Kerry spoke directly to the people of Paris and all of France. "Every American stands with you today. We stand with you in solidarity and in commitment, both to the cause of confronting extremism and in the cause which the extremists fear so much and which has always united our 2 countries.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Inilah VOA DC, langsung dari Washington.
Halo, ini Irfan.